My name is Cade Courtley, and this is Can You Survive This Podcast. This show is designed to teach you techniques that will increase your chances of survival in any life-threatening disaster scenario imaginable. Join me each week as I challenge my guests to see if they have what it takes to get out alive. Knowledge is power, people. Can you survive this podcast? My fellow survivors, if you hear my voice, it means you are still alive, and it continues to be my mission to keep it that way. Folks, I'm Cade Courtley. Welcome to another episode of Can You Survive This Podcast. Folks, we have an amazing, amazing guest today. We've got a highly decorated Marine veteran, multiple deployments to Iraq, Afghanistan, in addition to having a very highly decorated career. This individual won a bronze medal in rowing. We'll get into that. He rode his bike by himself, supported, but a solo ride across the United States, over 5,100 miles. And if that's not enough, this guy did 31 marathons in 31 days, and he did it all with two prosthetic legs. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Rob Jones to the show. Rob, thanks for being here, buddy.
Thanks a lot for having me, brother. I really appreciate it.
I have never felt like more of a shitbag in my life than after reading that intro. I'm like, I am so not even getting close to my potential after hearing that. That's incredible.
I don't know, man. You've written a book. I haven't written any books yet.
Dude, you can write a book in your basement. You ran 31 marathons in 31 days with two prosthetic legs. That's insane.
Well, I'm not too far behind you. I do have a first draft written, so I'm not too far behind you. So you are going to lose that little bit of edge, I guess.
What's the title of it? Do you have a working title, or have you figured that out yet?
Survive, Recover, Live is the working title. And that's just kind of, it's a mantra that I came up with, I guess, in my first week out of the ICU after I kind of started getting my senses back. I think I just went on Facebook, probably a little bit half high on morphine, and just typed out like, well, I just came up with a mantra, survive, recover, live. So I've kind of used that in a lot of my things that I've done, that mantra. Well,
I can't wait to get into that here in a minute, but explain to folks. So you're in the Marine Corps, you were with a construction battalion unit. Is that accurate?
Sort of. I mean, combat engineers, I'm sure, you know, we cover many, many, many disciplines. Part of that discipline is construction, but generally the unit that I was with was a CEB unit, and CEBs, combat engineer battalion, usually those are primarily tasked with using explosives and route clearance, kind of in direct attachment to infantry battalions. So if they needed us to, you know, do some construction, we could certainly do that. But there are certainly other combat engineer units that are more practiced in construction. So I would say my primary role was route clearance in Afghanistan.
So as a combat engineer in Afghanistan, explain what your tasking or your mission was.
Yeah, so I would get attached. Basically, we arrived as a platoon along with 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine Corps Regiment, and then each one of our squads went with one of the companies. So I was attached to Kilo Company of 3-7. And they just sent me out with a platoon, and we lived with them, you know, at the FOB that they were at. And then eventually when we moved from Delaram, Afghanistan, to starting to do a push into Sangin, Afghanistan, again, I was just living with 3rd Platoon of Kilo Company. And basically how it would work would be, any time that we were out and we thought that there was a likelihood that there was an IED in an area that we were about to go through, I would go through and clear it first, and then kind of leave a little trail of breadcrumbs behind me. And when I got to the other side, I would wave everybody else across. The rest of everybody would follow my little trail of breadcrumbs. So kind of like if we were going to cross a bridge going over a big river, well, the Taliban knows that we're going to have to use that bridge basically. And we're not going to like swim in 100 pounds of gear across the river. So they say, all right, well, they're probably going to, when they go north, they're probably going to use this bridge. So we're going to put our IEDs on this bridge because it's a likely avenue that they're going to take. So
yeah, they're taking a choke point and taking advantage of it. Now, were you working with EOD?
Not directly. So basically the way it works, there's a lot less EOD than there are combat engineers and infantry. So basically EOD in a general sense would kind of stay centralized. Mm-hmm. And then when we found an IED, if we decided that it was something that they should come out for, we would call them and then they would come and take care of it, whether it was blowing it in place or sometimes they'd remove it if it was a danger to civilians. Now, there would be certain times where if you're doing a really big push, you're doing a big clearance operation, EOD can go out there and find IEDs as well. They have the training on metal detectors, but generally they would kind of wait for us to call them.
So your SOP was basically, if we think there's something there, we're just going to blow it in place. There's none of this, like you see in the movies, people are like, oh, he's out there, he's cutting the blue wire. No, you're blowing it in place, right? Is that accurate? Or
we would pass off responsibility for that decision to EOD after we uncover the ID. So basically, in order to confirm that you should call EOD, you do have to go in with your fingers and actually move the dirt around and actually see something that you think is an IED.
Okay.
So, you know, if we saw, I would use a metal detector. So if I was sweeping and I got a metal hit and then I knelt down and I kind of moved the dirt around and I see the top of a jug or a shampoo bottle or a battery, at that point, I'm like, okay, this is probably an IED. So at that point, you know, I can make the decision to let EOD come out, or we can make the decision to uncover it as much as we can, you know, do them a little favor and uncover everything. Because once you know where all the components are, you know, if you're careful, there's not a whole lot of danger if it's just a pressure plate.
What about a remote detonation, though? I mean, having to worry about, okay, I'm down here clearing this thing, and there might be some asshole with a cell phone, you know, over on that hill.
That's a possibility. And usually, if we were with vehicles, we have jammers. Mm-hmm. And we had man-packable jammers. I don't recall if we actually used them. I know I didn't have one on my back. I probably should have, you know, since I was the IED guy, I probably should have just been like, give me one of them jammers.
Yeah, until you have a brain tumor the size of a cue ball.
Yeah, that's true too. I don't die from an IED. I'll die from brain cancer.
Right.
But generally speaking, I mean, you kind of go based on statistics too. Like 95% of the IEDs out there in our area were pressure plates. And then, you know, if they see me starting to find their ID, they're going to blow it up anyway. So
yeah, when we were rolling around in Iraq and they would say, hey, if the last thing you're going to see maybe is just a flash and that's all you really need to worry about.
Yeah.
you got blown up. A crazy conversation to have, but can you explain the experience from basically when you woke up? If there's anything, yeah. I mean,
I don't remember seeing a flash, to be honest with you. I remember hearing an explosion. So it's kind of interesting because I think really what it is a memory of an explosion, really. So I don't remember hearing the explosion in the moment, mm-hmm. but I do remember an explosion sound. And I think it was probably, I don't know. It's very, obviously it's very hazy at that point because I got knocked out unconscious instantly. And then I woke up 20 seconds later. So I remember hearing an explosion. I guess I heard it in the moment. But yeah, and you know, when you wake up, it's a lot like you would expect. And the movies do a pretty accurate representation of this. Whenever somebody gets hit by an explosion, it's screaming. It is that kind of visceral scream where all your pride as a man, as a Marine, as a SEAL or whatever, that is out the window. I mean, you don't have a choice. You could be, you know how when somebody pinches your arm or something, you can like, you can kind of hold back your wince of pain. But in this situation, the pain is so great. It's just my body basically disconnected from my brain, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of going on survival mode at that point. So like I wasn't telling my body to scream, but I could hear it. You know what I mean? So I could hear that. That's what I could hear. What I saw was basically tunnel vision, very, very blurry tunnel vision. And all I could see really was the sky. So it's just a very blurry tunnel that kind of led up to a very bright blue sky.
Did you deal with sort of the time slowed down before it kind of caught back up? You know, you hear about a lot of this stuff, people in these crazy life-threatening situations, and they're like, it just slowed down to a microsecond at a time.
Not really for me because, I mean, the event, the quote-unquote event, I mean, it was an instantaneous thing. And so I really didn't experience the event itself because the shockwaves travel so fast that it just knocked me out instantly. So I didn't really experience the explosion itself. I just experienced waking up afterwards 20 seconds later. And so really, I didn't really have any experiences at that point because my brain was just totally shut down. I was experiencing my most base emotions and feelings. I mean, all I could smell and taste was like dust and you know, after an explosion, I'm sure you've smelled a lot of C4 explosions. You know how that kind of, I don't know how to explain it.
It's kind of like that cordite.
A very unique taste. Yeah. A very unique smell. That's just like this kind of chemically stench. So I could smell that and dust combined. But yeah, I was pretty out of it for 20 seconds and I was only feeling, and all I could hear was just, you know, this loud ringing, you know, that took over everything. So I don't remember quite like what you're saying where time slowed down, but it was certainly very discombobulating for sure. Like I wasn't thinking clearly.
Did you just instinctively go start doing the body check, like the head to toe, or were people on you just like, don't move, stay put?
No, I check. I mean, I probably experienced what I was just talking about for maybe 15, 20 seconds while my body kind of, I guess I had to pump through the endorphins and go into survival mode. And then once that happened, 20 seconds later, you know, everything started calming down and things started coming back to me. And at that point, I could hear my fellow Marines like yelling out, you know, we're coming. But the difficulty in that situation is when you step on an IED, there's almost guaranteed to be a second or a third one there. So the sad circumstances of this situation is that people can't just run over to you right away as much as they want to and as much as you want them to. They can't just sprint over to you because, you know, there's a very good chance that they would hit another IED. And for all we know, that IED could be daisy chained into, you know, and everybody could get killed. So luckily, as a combat engineer, what you do is before you start a sweep, you make sure everybody else is offset from you just in case this kind of thing happens. So really, there was another engineer in the area. They brought him over. He swept to me. I imagine it was probably a very expedited sweep. It's hard to, you know, sit there and be as meticulous as you need to be when your brother's bleeding out.
Yeah.
So they got to me pretty quickly. And then, you know, from there, they did life-saving techniques. And before they got there, you know, to answer your question, I checked my hands, you know, I looked and saw my hands. I was like, dang, 10 fingers, okay. And then checked the spot where every man's going to check. And, you know, it was numb. So I didn't, you know, I was unsure of how things were going down there. And then everybody got over to me. And they put the tourniquets on, got the shot of morphine from the corpsman. And then at that point, everything really kind of, I really calmed down from that. But at the same time, I just kind of started saying, you know, whatever was on my mind. And I asked about my groin and, you know, I was reassured that it was fine. I actually sat up for a couple seconds to look at my legs. I knew they were going to be gone, parts of them. And I started sitting up to look, but I got like maybe 60% of the way. And I kind of had that feeling, you know, when you're a kid, you scratch your knee, it doesn't hurt. And then when you look at it, it's like, ah,
yeah.
I kind of got afraid that that was going to happen. I was like, I was feeling okay. And then I sat up to look and I thought, well, if I see my legs, you know, is it just going to be like this unbearable pain? So I just laid back down and waited for them to put me on a stretcher and take me away.
So you're off to the hospital, you're medevaced or you're pulled out by vehicle, you're in the hospital. When do you wake up and it starts sinking in what's happened to you?
I mean, I kind of knew on site. I mean, I knew pieces of my legs were missing. And I actually asked the guys that were with me, you know, am I above the knee or below the knee? Because that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And at site of injury, they told me it was below the knee. But by the time I got back to the hospital, my amputations had to be revised so that I was above the knee. So that was a bit of a surprise. Because that side of injury, I was told below the knee. And then when I wake up, it's actually double above the knee. But I woke up maybe 3 days later in Germany. Mm-hmm.
You in Ramstein at that point?
Landstuhl.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. You're not supposed to wake up at any point. I guess they try and keep you sedated until you get back to the States. But I woke up very briefly in Germany. And my squad leader just happened to be there. And he kind of told me what happened. And so I wasn't totally surprised. And obviously, I was still very, very, very out of it on morphine and Dilaudid and all these other painkillers. But I was a little bit surprised that it was above the knee. But that's just what you have to do. There's a lot of different reasons that you could be below the knee on site and above the knee later, like infections from the dirt. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, my brothers could have been seeing that there was flesh down below the knee. But whether or not there's anything viable down there for a prosthetic, then, you know, the orthopedic surgeon could have seen it and been like, you know, there's no way there's going to be a prosthetic attached to this, so we just have to amputate higher.
Rob, this is the most fascinating part about what I've learned about you so far. Now, I already talked about everything you've done post-Marine Corps. with getting a bronze medal for rowing, and then all of the marathons, riding your bike across America. That's the amazing sum of what you've done so far in your life post-event. My biggest question for you is, what was it that took you from, okay, my legs are gone above the knees, but I am going to do this and this and this. I want to dig into your brain about what was it? Was there a moment? Was there somebody that came and talked to you? Or was it just a, okay, I'm not done? Because there are a lot of people in that situation that would be like, I quit. And you clearly have done the opposite. What was it?
I think it was kind of, it was a magical cocktail of a lot of different things that I was just kind of lucky to be imbued with. Before I was in this situation, you know, part of it was the Marine Corps teaches you to detach from your emotions and detach from really any situation and just keep moving forward with the mission. And so I think that imbued in me an uncanny ability to accept, very quickly accept a situation and just determine what I need to do in order to get to the next step of my mission. So if you're out on a mission and something happens that really messes you up, well, you still have to accomplish the mission. And the sooner you accept that your original plan is not going to work, the faster you can come up with this next, you know, plan B, plan C, and transition to that. So, you know, I was taught that in the Marine Corps. And so I was able to use that very effectively, not knowing it really in the moment, but, you know, I guess subconsciously. So I realized that, you know, my mission for life isn't just, you know, being in the Marine Corps fighting terrorists, you know, overseas. That was a plan to accomplish my mission. But my mission was, and everybody's mission is in their life, you know, have a meaningful life and have an enjoyable life. And so, you know, being in the Marine Corps is just one way that I was able to try and make that happen. And when I stepped in the ID, well, you know, that way that wasn't necessarily over, but I realized that the mission's still there. You know, I still want to have an enjoyable life. I still want to have a meaningful life. And so if I sit here and just dwell on the fact that my original plan didn't work and this is unfair and I don't want to be a double above knee amputee, et cetera, that's less time and less energy I have to put into actually accomplishing this mission and coming up with plan B and plan C. So it's partly that. I think I also was able to think more selflessly. So for example, I knew that my mom was going to be really upset by the news that I had been wounded. So just thinking about what was going to be best for her was that I'd be fine. I'd be okay. And so because that was what was best for her and what was best for the rest of my family and my friends and actually my brothers that I left back in Afghanistan, you know, if word got back to them that I got wounded and I was depressed and struggling and all this stuff, you know, how is that going to affect their combat readiness? And so me being okay was what was best for everybody in my life. And so because of that, I was able to manifest that in myself a lot easier. So I was thinking about them before myself, and that was what caused me to rise to the occasion. And then later on, you know, that's kind of initial the stuff. And then later on, when I thought about doing the month of marathons and the bike ride across the country and all this stuff, you know, it's kind of more about that saying in the Marine Corps, once a Marine, always a Marine. So kind of still having the responsibility to serve your country and fight for your fellow Marines and fellow veterans. And, you know, that doesn't go away just because you're wounded or just because you retire. And so that was kind of my way of continuing that service to both those people.
Well, I mean, that's incredibly selfless. The fact that you've lost both your legs above the knee and you're thinking, oh, I feel my mom, my boys back there. I mean, that's awesome. They got your legs, but they didn't get your mindset, which is incredible. Exactly. And they can't get that, you know?
Not unless you let them.
Well, that's very true. And it sounds like you made a very rapid transition to, okay, what's my next mission? I mean, that's the kind of thing that keeps people going in a situation like yours.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't, you know, I wasn't thinking, you know, what's my next mission specifically. At that point, I was thinking, well, the mission is still there. You know, the have an enjoyable life, have a meaningful life, that's still there. How I'm going to do that, I don't know yet. But what I know that I need to do is actually recover. So I need to get through this hospital stay. I need to get through all these surgeries I'm going to have. And then I need to go into physical therapy and learn how to use prosthetic legs. So the specific overall, I guess the mission kind of became to recover and learn how to use the prosthetics to the best of my ability and get myself set up so that then I can transition to the next part of the mission. like kind of stage one and, you know, onward.
I mean, physical and mental toughness. Obviously, you were a Marine. You got that in the Marine Corps. But what was it like pre-Marine Corps for you? Because you had to have some of this as a foundation. Because I think without going in the Marine Corps with at least some of that as a foundation or a mindset, you don't just get that in basic training. You got to show up with some of that.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say I was necessarily mentally weak. I definitely had a lot more of a penchant for just giving up on things before the Marine Corps. I grew up on a farm, so I definitely had an incredible work ethic and the ability to do things that I really didn't want to do. Like I grew up, you know, mucking horse stalls and weed whacking miles and miles of fence lines and that kind of thing. All things I really didn't want to do, but I did them because my family needed me to. So I had that ability to be able to do things that I don't really want to. So that's part of it. So that's really all I had before I joined the Marine Corps. And then, you know, deploying to Iraq 2008 definitely aided the mindset that I needed to have in 2010 when I got wounded in boot camp and learning from all these other Marines that I was with too.
I'd like to get into post-event. Give me an idea of how long it took for you to recover before you start saying, all right, I think rowing sounds pretty cool. I think that's going to be my first physical mission.
I'd say 3 weeks after I was wounded, I started looking up sports that I could do.
3 weeks.
Yeah, not like, that's, you know, awesome. In a way that I was like, I'm going to go to the Paralympics, but 3 weeks after I was wounded, I was laying in my hospital bed. I had a laptop. I was just like, man, I really like being active, you know, working out and doing sports and that kind of thing. And so maybe what sports can I do now as a double above knee amputee? So I started researching disabled sports, found, you know, this disabled rowing, or I think they call it adaptive rowing at the time. Now it's para rowing. I remembered rowing workouts on the erg machine were a ball breaker. So I was like, well, you know, I really love a good workout. So maybe this rowing, this adaptive rowing thing can be something that I can pursue. And then as I looked into it more, I saw that it was in the Paralympics. Like, oh, well, what the heck is the Paralympics? So I Googled that as well. Like, huh, interesting. And so I had always been interested in the life of an athlete. I don't know why. Just kind of maybe this, that dedication to one thing for such a long time and competing at the highest level in the world. And that kind of, yeah, that kind of dedication, that discipline that it requires to be able to do that. Maybe that was what attracted me to it. So I knew I had to recover first. So I kind of put it in the back of my head that maybe this is something I could come to later on. And maybe I could go to the Paralympics in 2012. So I definitely thought about it. I have a tendency to have a big idea very early on and then kind of put it to the side for a long time and then come back to it and be like, maybe I should do that, you know? So I think that's kind of how it worked, where I was just looking for sports that I could do during my recovery and just so happened to come upon the Paralympics, and then a lot of other things had to fall into place afterwards. But yeah, that's how it happened.
So I know you trained your ass off for that, and the result of that was a bronze medal in the Paralympics. That's epic.
Yeah, 2012.
I mean, what was that experience like? It had to be totally rewarding. I mean, next mission, man. New life.
Yeah, you know, like I said, a lot of things had to fall into place. Like I needed a female partner. Because the rowing, the double skull rowing in the Paralympics is a guy and a girl. And, you know, just so happened that there was this really incredible female rower that had been looking for a partner for years and years that had the dedication to go to the Paralympics. So, and our coaches just so happened to know each other. And it turns out we worked well together and she was able to dedicate full-time training to it. But yeah, it was 10 months of full-time, you know, twice a day. That's all we did was train. And then eat and then go to bed for 10 months of that. And then there was a couple big races along the way where we had to become the national team for the United States. So we had to win this one race. If we lose this race, we're done. And that was, you know, that race came about after 3 months of training together. And it was against a crew that had a person that was already on the national team. So it was like this really, and we won by 12 seconds, you know. And then after that, we had to qualify the boat for the Paralympics. And if we don't come in first or second place, we're done. And this is, you know, world level, our first ever world level race. We're racing against people that have been in the Paralympics before. We won that. Then we get to the Paralympics and we're just kind of unknown. Nobody knows who the heck we are. We're just these people that have been, that are at this, the Paralympics 2012 have been like racing together for almost 4 years since 2008, you know? Mm-hmm. And so nobody knew who the heck we were. They just know that we did well in the Paralympic qualifier. I don't know if anybody expected us to medal or anything, but we were able to, you know, pull that out by 0.2 of a second. And obviously the race was high stress. And, you know, by the end of the race, I couldn't feel my arms. You know, that's how tired you are.
So you're like, okay, I can't feel my legs or my arms anymore.
Yeah. Like, I don't know how I was feathering the blades in the water. I don't know how I was holding on, but I held on. But if, you know, if I had backed off, or if my rowing partner had backed off for even a split second, you know, we would have lost and been fourth. And this could have been a totally different story. But we were able to hold on. And
so you said that was 0.2 seconds between
0.2 of a second, yeah.
Podium and thanks for coming.
Nothing.
That's awesome.
And then, you know, in rowing, in a lot of sports, and rowing especially, that's kind of a lot of races are decided by that tiny of a margin. And that's like, you know, half a boat length, if that. So, yeah. It was an incredible experience. And, you know, I walked away with a bronze medal, but, you know, that's also where I met my wife, Pam. So I kind of walked away with something even better.
A gold and a bronze.
Yeah. Well, she won gold in that same Paralympics in a different boat
class.
Really?
What event? Same in rowing?
She was in a boat called the Legs, Trunk and Arms Mixed Coxed 4. So a 4-person boat. I was in a 2-person boat. And then she's an incredible athlete as well. You know, she won Paralympic gold in 2012 and 2016.
Wow.
And world championships all the way from 2011 to 2015. So, see, that's 6 championships, which I like to tell people is as many as Michael Jordan. So,
that's amazing. Let me ask you something. Do you believe in luck, karma, fate? Where are you at with that? Or everything happens for a reason? I guess that's kind of fate, but I mean, do you have?
I don't know, man. I don't think I'm quite as spiritual as believing in those things. Like there's some sort of force that's driving it. I mean, a lot of the times it feels like things are meant to be, you know, looking back in retrospect and, you know, if I hadn't been wounded, I wouldn't have met my wife and I wouldn't have, you know, have everything I have now. And so it's hard to deny that kind of feeling, but I kind of do think that things just happen. Mm-hmm. And then the way you react to them is the way that if you react in a certain way, then other opportunities are opened up. So if you react in the right way, I made it possible to meet my wife by being open to the fact that, hey, maybe I can use this as an opportunity to get into sports that I wouldn't have otherwise. And if I had just been like, well, my life's over, I guess. And then I would have never had that opportunity to go to the Paralympics and never would have met my wife. And you know, so I think it's more about our reactions to life events that just happen to you, more than, you know, fate or anything like that, luck or karma or anything like that.
So Paralympics, awesome. Met your wife. you get yeah, the podium and you say to yourself, I think I want to ride my bike across America. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. You know, well, I enjoyed rowing and rowing was a very important part of my recovery because it was kind of my first big challenge. Like I'm going to dedicate myself to this and try and, you know, obviously I wanted to win in the Paralympics, but the fact that we got a bronze medal after 10 months is like a pretty huge accomplishment. And so I felt like it was a success. So it was very important in regaining my self-confidence and my self-reliance and that kind of thing was me being successful in this rowing thing. And so I did another year after that and placed 4th in world championships the next year. But kind of over the course of the 2012 season and the 2013 season, it just didn't feel like it was something that I wanted to do long term. I didn't really know why. I just didn't feel quite settled in doing it long term. Mm-hmm. And so I started, you know, thinking about other things that I could do to get me onto the right path, which was towards this meaningful and fulfilling and enjoyable life for me. And when I was in recovery, it took me 9 months of practice to learn how to ride a normal bicycle again, which is something that I don't think any other double above knee amputee that went through Walter Reed has, you know, ever did. It's a very, you know, there's like 3 or 4 guys in the whole world that can ride a bicycle as a double above knee amputee. So I wanted to put that to use. And over the course of that time that I was learning, I kind of used endurance athletes as a way to motivate myself. I really admired them. And so I read books about, you know, the Race Across America and ultras and things like that. And so in my way, I kind of like, well, maybe one day I should ride my bike across the country or something. You know, that might be kind of fun and kind of cool thing to do. And so in 2012, 2013, I wasn't feeling quite in the right spot. And I was just thinking about, well, then I kind of came back to that idea. And on top of that, I figured it could be a good way to raise money for veteran charities and raise awareness about veteran issues. So it kind of had a double, you know, I figured it would be enjoyable. And I also figured it would be a good way to push myself and test myself, and also a good way to continue to serve.
There has to be, like, I'm sure there were hundreds of memories from that, but was there one sort of snapshot when you're riding across America on that bike? You're like, I'll never forget this. This is an epic moment for me.
I'll give you two. Well, I mean, just pretty much three I'll give you. Every time I rolled into a town and there was people waiting to greet me and help me out, I mean, that's extremely powerful. And just the number of people that heard about me wanting to do this, and just, I've made lifelong friends, you know, from, I came up with the idea, I put it on Facebook, and I just had a bunch of people have reached out to me and said, I want to help you with this. You know, particularly my friend Tina, she was the friend of a childhood friend, and she's like, I want to help you do this. And she was a huge part of getting me set up and helping me with communications and that kind of stuff, because I sucked at it. And then throughout the course of the ride, more and more people kind of came on. Like, I rode through Boston, and a couple people there became huge parts of the rest of the ride, and then Pennsylvania. And then, like, kind of as I went, more and more people kind of like really latched on to the mission and became huge parts of it.
Dude, were you like Forrest Gump on a bike, basically? And they just started adding on and adding on before you know it, you've got this whole crew behind you.
Not quite. I mean, it was the winter time. I have to remember, it was the polar vortex. So not many people were riding with me until I got to California. So that's one thing. And then second was when I was going through Missouri, Ozark Mountains, I actually hit a patch of black ice on my bike and slipped and slammed into the asphalt, but I was fine. But then I was like, all right, well, it's too dangerous to ride, because it was, you know, way below freezing and it was raining, and then, you know, perfect conditions for black ice. So I got back in the truck, and my brother went over that same patch in the U-Haul, and we ended up sliding off the road and tipping onto our side in the truck.
Oh.
And I was sitting there thinking, like, oh my God, the ride's over. This is a disaster. What are we going to do? This is going to take me like a month to get it. I'm going to have to get another truck. This one's probably ruined. But, you know, we climbed out of there. I called the local fire department. They came out and they got a wrecker, pulled it out. Truck started right up. And there was not even the side view mirror was broken. It was just, all that had happened was the back of everything we had in the back of the U-Haul was just kind of jumbled up. So we drove back to the hotel, and it rained, and it warmed up a little bit. And it's like 12 o'clock. I'm like, hey, look, we got to go. I have to go out and ride again, because if we wait till tomorrow, it's going to be black ice again. So we hopped in the truck, drove out there. Ice had melted, so I rode through that area. And then we pushed on. And so that's kind of, not sure what the lesson is in that, but, you know, just letting the situation develop and then taking advantage, not letting a bad situation discombobulate you so much that you can't see clearly enough on what to do. Because if I had just been totally freaked out by that whole thing, then I would have waited till the next day and it would have been too dangerous. And then who knows how much longer I would have been stuck there. But because I was kind of able to put that aside, accept it, that it happened, process it, and then be like, well, actually what I need to do is actually ride again in the same day where, you know, we had this big disaster.
Rob, I got a feeling you're not the kind of guy who likes just kind of sitting around.
From time to time, I like sitting around when I've earned it. And then the third was probably riding through southern Utah. There was this 100-mile stretch where there's no towns or anything. So it was just me and my brother. And the temperatures had warmed up. It was probably like 70 degrees. I was in a t-shirt. It was February. And I was just riding through southern Utah, which is extremely beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that was like 3-4 days of just camping out and riding my bike. And so that was probably – and then the finish, obviously. But yeah.
Well, as if you're not an overachiever enough, you decide, all right, made it across America on a bike. I think I'm going to start running marathons. And you did 31 marathons in 31 days. I did the math. That's over 812 miles in 31 days.
Yeah.
All right. So rowing, check. Biking, cycling, check. Might as well start running.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of another, this is a good example of how a failure can lead to a positive thing. after I finished the bike ride, I wanted to make the Paralympics again in 2016. So I started training in triathlons, and I was able to get down to, so that the Paralympic triathlon is a sprint. So the run part of it is 5 kilometers. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get down to 18 minute 5K, which is the max score for the Marine Corps PFT, mm-hmm. with like training once a week for, you know, 9 months. It kind of made me remember my kind of natural penchant for running. I'd always been a pretty decent runner all the way from elementary school onward. I'd always been kind of a natural runner, and it kind of reminded me of that. And as a way to kind of, after the 2015 season was over, as a way to kind of have a little fun, I decided to run the Marine Corps Marathon on no training. The furthest I'd ever run was 5 kilometers. And I said, ah, screw it. I'll do it.
Just grind it.
I'll take my time. And I ran it in like 4 hours and 12 minutes. And so that kind of showed me that I can run marathons too. And at that time, I was still training for the Paralympics. So I just kind of put that aside. But then ultimately, I wasn't able to qualify for the Paralympics in 2016 for a variety of reasons. And so in that moment, I had to think of, you know, what's next. And so I really enjoyed the giving back aspect of the bike ride and the endurance sports aspect of it. And, you know, I relearned that I was a pretty decent runner, and I enjoyed running the Marine Corps Marathon. So, well, there was a couple. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Let me ask you this. So rowing, cycling, considered low impact, unless of course you come off and fly over the handlebars, yeah. But those are both low impact sports. Was there a concern? Okay, I'm going from low impact sports to, holy shit, 812 miles and 31 days of running. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you sit down with the docs? Did you adjust or go work with different prosthetics, considering this incredible challenge / next mission that you put ahead of yourself?
Yeah. I didn't really sit down with any physicians and ask them about it, but just because nobody had ever done it before. So I knew they would, and generally doctors are going to have you play it safe because they don't give a shit about your, you know, wanting to raise money. They care about your physical well-being. They have that Hippocratic oath.
Sure.
So yeah, I was very concerned about whether or not my hips would be able to withstand the force, whether or not my stumps go into a prosthetic. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the prosthetic hits and flexes, that force goes up into the prosthetic socket, which goes up into my leg. So whether or not the bottoms of my stumps would be able to withstand it, then on the inside, there's also friction there.
Yeah.
Because they're not, you know, no matter how comfortable of a socket you get, there's always going to be a little bit of friction. So whether or not my skin on my stumps would be able to withstand it too. And I didn't really work too much with the prosthetist on it because there's only so much you can do. You just get the socket comfortable, and my sockets were very comfortable, as comfortable as I figured I could get them. And there's only so many different running prostheses you can get. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I did do with my prosthesis was figure out which one would be optimal, and we decided on the one that I used.
And it optimal as far as maybe absorbing some of the compression or absorbing some of the
impact? They all absorb the compression, impact. But it's about efficiency more than anything. Uh-huh. The ones I used are this kind of C-shaped one, and they're pretty light. And the other ones are kind of these big J-shaped one. They have a lot of carbon fiber in them. They're more for high impact, really high impact, like sprinting type of stuff. So they're very thick and very robust. And we decided, you know, the speed that I was going to be running, I was going to be more for this. And I'm going to be running long distances. So it's more about every ounce on the bottom of your foot when you're running is, you know, that over 26 miles, that really adds up. And so we decided on that. And then there's different categories of how much flex the running prostheses had. So we, based on your weight category and how fast you're going to be running, we kind of decided on this one. So that's kind of how we came to that conclusion. But besides that, it was just more of an athletic endeavor. You know, these are the problems that I need to correct. I need a huge cardiovascular engine mm-hmm. in order to do this. I need to fat adapt so that I can run at a speed that doesn't create glycolysis, which, you know, uses sugars, and then those create a ton of byproducts that can do damage. So I need to run at a speed. I need to adapt those systems, kind of fat lipidology type of thing.
What were the splits or your mile times that you were trying to keep? This is kind of the zone that's going to work best for me. given what you're doing?
I would just run by based on heart rates. I use this training method called the Maffetone method. And it's essentially a different way of calculating your max aerobic heart rate. So I just wanted to stay in that aerobic zone where 99% of my energy production is coming from burning fats instead of sugars. And then, you know, I just kind of did my little calculation on, well, this is the heart rate that I need to stay under. And so I did all my training under that heart rate. You try and get as close to it as you can, because that's going to be the best place to train that system. Mm-hmm. And then whenever I ran a marathon, I just had a couple watches that I would wear on either wrist, and I would just check it frequently. You make sure it was under 150 beats per minute, and I would just, that's it. That's all I would do. I wouldn't look at any speed or anything. But generally, on a good day, I was probably running 830s.
That's incredible. What was your best time?
My best time, running time. So one of the things I wanted to do, I knew I had to do, was pace each day and pace the whole thing entirely. So what I did was I figured, look, I have 24 hours to run a marathon and drive my RV from that marathon to the next marathon and sleep. I have 24 hours to do all that. So it's like, I don't have to be sprinting these marathons. I have some time to make it happen because this is all I'm doing. So I figured, all right, well, I want to pace these things. So I'll run. What I would do is run 12 kilometers, take a 20-minute break, run 12 kilometers, take a 20-minute break, run 9.5 kilometers, take a break, and then run the last like 8, whatever it was. And so when somebody asked me, well, how long would it take you to run a marathon? Yeah. It kind of depends on, are you counting the rest times?
Right. Yeah.
If you are, so running time, my best time was 3:49 running time. And then you add on like the hour's worth of rest. I wish I would have had the chance to run, a marathon and just see how fast I could have done one, but didn't really have that chance.
Well, you should add it to the list. I mean, obviously you got tons of time on your hands right now and
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to, I did the Marine Corps 50K last year, so I'm still doing this stuff. So yeah, maybe next time I do a marathon, I'll actually, kind of train for time and instead of just training for completion.
How come, why the number 31? Was it because I don't want to do 32 or logistically that just made sense?
Yeah, logistically it made sense. Well, so I originally thought, well, maybe I'll do 20 because, the veteran suicide number is 20.
Right.
But when I thought about that, I was like, 20 is not long enough, but because by the time I really get rolling and people start hearing about it, I'm going to be done. So I figured I want to do longer than 20. And I was like, well, maybe what about 50? It's like, well, 50 might be a little bit too long because after a certain amount of time, people are going to stop paying attention. And I wanted to, the main reason to do it was creating a story that people were going to really pay attention to for a long time. So I was like 50. I figure people would probably pay attention to it for about a month before they started to move on to other things. So, all right, so we have a month. Well, the longest month is 31 days. So that's it.
So for anybody out there who's never run a marathon, Rob just said 20 isn't enough. You're insane, dude.
20's not enough.
Rob, another question I'm dying to ask you here. When you hear people complaining, what is your reaction? Just complaining in general. Complaining about, I don't like my job, my back hurts. Are you just like, all right, whatever, or you gotta be shitting me?
Well, everybody, it's all just a matter of perspective. I complain too, and I could be, I complain about stuff, and you probably usually catch myself, a little bit more often than most people. But at the same time, if I complain, you could have a quadruple amputee talking about, well, at least you have your arms. So like if I complain about my back hurting from walking around in prosthetics, or I complain about being hot when I'm outside in July in Virginia, it's hot because of my prosthetics, or, they bottle in all the heat. Well, okay, there's a quadruple amputee out there somewhere that has those prosthetics and then arm prosthetics on too. So, it's just a matter of perspective, and my reaction would just be to maybe help the person see that perspective. And instead of seeing whatever they're complaining about as a burden, maybe see it as an opportunity to use this as a way to grow.
Well, that kind of answers the next question a little bit. But for a veteran out there who's struggling in one way or another, physically, mentally, emotionally, or anybody who's out there just having a hard time, and a lot of people are right now. In addition to just your positive attitude, get a mission, don't quit, what would you say to those folks that could be helpful?
Yeah, I mean, that would be part of it. So the key to overcoming anything and enduring anything and accomplishing anything in your life is what I've learned is selflessness. So whatever challenge you are facing, you can overcome it if you think about why overcoming it is important to the people that you care about more than yourselves, or the things that you care about more than yourself, the places that you care about more than yourself. So figure out why those people or what their best interests necessitate you overcoming this thing or doing the thing that you really don't want to do or is really difficult. So let's say walking through a minefield with a metal detector. I didn't want to do that, but my fellow Marines they needed me to do it. And so I never even hesitated. I just did it. Recovering from my mom needed me to be okay. So that's what was in her best interest. And I care about her more than I care about myself. So look, I was okay. And then the bike ride, the month of marathons. Well, I figured there's very few people I care about more than my fellow veterans, you know, Marines and any kind of veteran. And so what I felt like we needed at that time was a positive story that everybody can use. Because in the media lately, it's like the picture of a veteran is they're either a war hero overseas or they come home and they're a basket case.
Yeah.
It's like there aren't a whole lot of positive coming home stories in the media right now. And so I set out to create that story because I saw that need. And so in order to create that story, well, I had to go run a bunch of marathons and ride my bike across the country. I didn't, you know, between October 12th and November 11th of 2017, I didn't really want to wake up and run 42.2 kilometers in circles or back and forth. You know, I didn't want to have to run 23 times around the Harlem Mirror in Central Park. In the last 4 days, I had a back injury in Nashville. I didn't want to have to wake up and feel this kind of excruciating sharp pain go up my back every time I landed on my right foot and then have to do that 80,000 times. I didn't want to have to do any of that stuff, but I did it because my fellow veterans, my fellow Marines were relying on me to make that happen, to finish this story, to create this story and make it successful. And that's the key. So figuring out why the best interests of the people that you care about more than yourself, your mom, your dad, your wife, your kids, your friends, why their best interest necessitates you to overcome whatever this is or do whatever it is you don't really want to do. And then, so that's the key to making it happen. But, you know, it's also this, I call it use the weight is my mantra there. Life's going to have challenges that are unexpected. And it's kind of like being in the gym with a barbell where it's on your shoulders, you know, this weight's on your shoulders. And, you know, that weight's kind of like this challenge or a stress that's in your life. And so when it's on your shoulders, you have two options. You know, your first option is just sit there with it, resist it, hold on to it for as long as you can. But eventually, hey, your energy is finite. You're going to get weighed down by it. The stresses are going to wear you down. And you're just going to kind of slowly sink down to the floor until eventually that you fall over because you can't hold it anymore. And the weight's on your back, pinned across your back. Can't do anything with it. Can't help yourself. Can't help anybody. Or when that weight's on your shoulders, you can take it and you can strict press it and you do it again and again and again. And every time you put that weight over your head, you adapt to it a little bit more and more and more, or you adapt to that stress that you have in your life. And eventually you start, because you adapted to that weight, now you can handle even bigger weights, bigger stresses, bigger challenges in your life, until it gets to a point where eventually there's not enough weight in the gym. There's not a big enough stress in the world that can stop you. You have to go out. You have to do what I call create the weight, where, you know, there's the gyms run out of weight. So you got to be like Bruce Willis in Unbreakable, where you get the paint cans and you put them on the side of your barbell too. You know, you have to go out and find ways that you can make your life more challenging so that you can continue to grow. And so that's whenever you're faced with a challenge or a stress, you need to have that attitude that how can I use this to my advantage to become stronger, become better. And then when that time gets tough, when it becomes difficult, you know, you use the selfless purpose that you have behind it to get through those tough times. So those two things kind of in tandem would be my message.
I haven't met anybody that's as inspiring as you in a long time. So I mean it. I really do. Genuinely mean it. I personally want to thank you. If anybody is out there looking for somebody to be a public speaker at their function, I can't think of anybody better. Rob, I know you out there. You've done this and you're currently doing some public speaking. How can somebody get a hold of you for that?
Yeah, my website, robjonesjourney.com. My email is robjonesjourney@gmail.com. But yeah, you know, that's what I do. I can't just run 31 marathons in 31 days every year. Well, maybe I could, but I don't want to. You can go on my website and look up the essay, I can't. It's all about that phrase. Anyway, I'm not going to, I'll say. So one way that I can continue to do good in this world is by continuing to tell this story that I've created to as many people and get that in front of as many people as possible. So yeah, public speaking and doing this kind of thing at any kind of event, I like to go into schools too, is a way for me to continue to do that. So that's a main mission of mine, is to do more and more public speaking.
Well, Rob, your message is amazing. It really is. Your life is amazing. And I mean, this is only a few chapters in, basically. I can't wait to see what the next insane mission is you're going to create. You live on a farm. You live on a working farm with your wife. What's it like? Yeah. What's farm life like? Is it?
Oh, I grew up on a farm too. The farm is it's my wife's business. It's her mission, and then my mission is to help her make it a success when I can. Obviously, I have my own stuff I'm working on in my own life, but whenever she needs my help with a big project, like building a big deer fence out there, or she's got a big chicken coop she's building right now for chickens, so I try and help her as much as I can with that. We have a son, Harry, who's 5 months old, so love spending time with him. And so, yeah, part of my helping with the farm is to make sure I take him to make sure that she can do her stuff out on the farm and make her business successful. So it's great. I love it. Love having fresh eggs every day. Love having fresh vegetables every day. But what I love more is just helping my wife, accomplish her, her dream, which is to run this farm and make it a success. So.
Well, Rob, I mean it. Incredibly inspiring. I have got to step up my game after chatting with you. I'm like, Jesus, I only did a half marathon. You don't get shin splints anymore, so that's got to be kind of cool, right? Is that a bonus?
That's true. I don't get shin splints. There are so many people that I would see Instagram comments where people are like, yeah, well, he doesn't have legs, so it's not as hard. So I think if people are just trying to be funny.
Or beyond ignorant.
I will tell you, it does hurt.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
My legs do get tired. What's left of them?
What's next?
Yeah, right now I'm just working on finishing my book. Like I said, I have a first draft written of a memoir, and so that. And then just trying to get the speaking thing going so I can, tell my story to as many people as possible. Those are two of the things I'm working on. I also have one other thing, but I'm not ready to talk about it just yet because I still need to do a little more planning. But those are the two things I'm primarily working on right now, is getting this book out and doing as many speaking engagements as I can in order to just continue to tell the story.
Well, it's an amazing story, and I can't wait to see what's next. Honestly, I'm looking forward to reading your book. Will you give your website again, Rob?
Yeah, robjonesjourney.com.
Awesome.
And then that's all my social media, is at robjonesjourney.
Well, buddy, thank you. Really, thank you for your time. Thank you for your service. Thank you for what you're doing. Incredibly inspiring, and we need this right now. I mean, we need it more than ever since I've been around. And folks, honestly,
yeah,
go to his website, book this guy for public speaking, get the message out there. Anything from you, man?
I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity to come talk to you. I hope that we can meet each other in person someday without the risk of a world killing virus stopping us. Thank you for what you did in the SEALs and for what you're doing with your books and everything. And I just really appreciate the opportunity, brother.
Well, thank you, man. I look forward to meeting you in person. We'll grab a cold beer, and I got to hear some more stories.
Yeah, let's do it. Where do you live?
I'm in Denver, Colorado right now.
Denver. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Yeah. I have family in Greeley, so I go out there all the time. So we'll definitely make that happen.
Oh, please do. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Buddy, thank you so much for your time. This was amazing. Folks, the best way to support our show is to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. You can also check out our YouTube channel for video content of all of our episodes. So ring that bell to subscribe. And if you have any survival questions you want answered, just leave it in the comments so you can be a survivor, not a statistic. Rob Jones, thank you so much, brother.
Thanks a lot, brother. Appreciate it.
Can You Survive This Podcast is a Cavalry Audio production recorded live from The Bunker in Denver, Colorado. Hosted by me, Kate Courtley. Produced by Brandon Morgan and Kate Courtley. Associate producer is Jeff Apple. Executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. Service, commitment, and integrity are the traits embodied by our nation's defenders, veterans, and first responders, and they are also the core values upon which the Gary Sinise Foundation is built. The Gary Sinise Foundation serves and honors our nation's defenders, veterans, first responders, their families, and those in need. Whether the Gary Sinise Foundation is providing specially adapted smart homes to severely wounded heroes, supporting Gold Star families, or providing essential equipment, training, and PPE to first responders, in all of the Foundation's programs, they honor those who so bravely defend our freedoms every day. Support our heroes today at GarySiniseFoundation.org.